Blog Talk Radio.
Jazz that we always listen to when we start this with James Oliver and with the horn by another brother, Louis Armstrong. It's the first time that a piece of jazz had departed with that solo introduction. I wasn't aware of this until I was happened to be listening to a jazz program on Sirius Radio, and they brought up the West End Blues. Who knew? 1924. Two Masons at it. I'm glad that you're back, and welcome to another episode of Sonic Home Companion. Here we are on the 16th of September, 2012. The 260th day of the year. It's kind of an interesting point. I want to talk a little bit about the equinox. We're coming up to it. It's coming up on the 22nd of September, somewhere around 4 something in the morning. Let's see, 1449. What does that mean? 14, that's 249. It's where it occurs twice a year when the tilt of the Earth's axis is inclined neither away nor towards the sun, and the center of the sun being in this same plane as the Earth's equator. So the term equinox can also be used in a broader sense, meaning the date when such a passage happens. It comes from Latin, of course, equal night, equus nox, because around the equinox, the day and night of approximately equal length. At an equinox, the sun is at one of two opposite points on the celestial sphere. These points intersect what's called the internoctial points. So the equinoxes are the only time when the subsolar point is on the equator. So hope if your life is spiraling, you never feel you're quite in control, that on the 22nd of September at 1449 hours, that you're going to experience balance in your life, because the great architect knows the other 7.5 billion of us are going to. You might as well join in. So remember, it's the only time when the terminator is inclined 90 degrees to the Earth's equator, the date in which sunset and sunrise becomes exactly 12 hours apart. There you have it. And I hope you celebrate it wildly. It's 260th day of the year. The year is going by. We're coming up to our anniversary. I think it was in December, wasn't it? The anniversary of the show. The growing interest and support for the Sonic Home Companion is quite rewarding and encourages me to put a little extra effort into everything that goes on around here. a special day in history. And of course, you'll remember this because I know some of you are old enough that you were there. 1400, Owain Glyndwr was declared Prince of Wales by his followers. And I know some of you still have the commemorative mug that went along with that. There's in 1630, the mass village of Shumut changed its name to Boston. I had forgotten that. In this day in history, in 1668, King John II of Casimir of Poland resigned and went to France. I wonder if he counts as a tourist. Who could blame him? It's also on this day in history that James Francis Edward Stuart, sometimes called the Old Pretender, became the Jacobite claimant to the throne of England and Scotland. And in 1702, Emperor Leopold I declared war on France. In 1795, the United Kingdom conquered Cape Town in South Africa. Old battles, huh? should remind us of a lot, to not perhaps be so cavalier or smug about the battles other people and other nations are having today. This is part of our history. In this day in 1858 was the first overland mail for California. Man, that was not that long ago, was it? And in 1862, Liukalana, the Queen of Hawaii, married John Owen Dominus. In 1867, the Ottawa Rough Riders and the Senators play the Canadian football game. 1867. I wonder why we have such a hard time reminding ourselves of some of these Canadian events. That was on this date. In 1892, the Amsterdam Swim Club was renamed the Y. Roland Amundsen discovered the magnetic South Pole today, 1906. And also on this day in 1908, William Durant, who was a carriage maker, founded General Motors Corporation. Then we get into more recent history. Tsar Nicholas II adjourned the Fourth Duma in 1915. 1913, thousands of women demonstrate for Dutch female suffrage. They wanted to vote. 1920, bomb explosion on Wall Street killed 30 people. The turmoil, we're coming up, is it today or tomorrow, to the one-year anniversary of the Occupy movement. People becoming aware of an economic imbalance. When risk takers win their bet, they profit. When they lose their bet, the people of these democracies, Western worlds, pay for the risk. And that's considered... that there's questions now about whether that's equitable and balanced, because it seems that the profits are resting on the efforts and consequence borne by average people. It's a strange way of thinking about the rethinking and reevaluating the world around us. In 1929, police shoot strikers in Maastricht. Now, Maastricht pours out the music of Strauss. Eh? In 1939, a blimp was moored to the Empire State Building. 1939, the New York Yankees clinched their 11th and 4th successive pennant. 1940, Leo Durocher suspended from Ebbets Field for inciting a riot. Then in that same year, the Luftwaffe attacked the center of London. Bad business for everybody. The next little part in history has to do with retaliations and barbarism of the war. You already know enough about that, I think. The stain on the conscience of mankind. The barometric pressure, 1945, dropped to 25.55 off Okinawa. That's the lowest pressure on record. In 1947, the world needed a distraction. John Cobb set the world auto speed record at 394.2 miles per hour. Heavenly, eh? In 1949, the year I was born, KABC Television, Channel 7 in Los Angeles, began broadcasting. We know that as ABC. In 1950, the Cleveland Rams, formerly of the All-American Football Conference, played its first NFL game. They beat Philadelphia 35-10. Marlene Bauer won the LGPGA Clock Golf Open in 1956. Great year for chefs, wasn't it? 1957 was a fantastic year. The LA City Council that year approved 300-acre site in Chavez Ravine for the Dodgers. Nostalgia for older fellows, I guess. 1964. All you suave, debonair, young bucks out there, remember that Shindig premiered on ABC. 1966, the Metropolitan Opera opened at New York's Lincoln Center. Ah. 1968, Richard Nixon appeared in Laugh-In. All in this day in history. It was strange times, eh? Strange times. Massacres, science events. On this day in 1987, NASA launched a space vehicle S-209. It's an odd history that we live. And when we look at it, we need to be reminded that we're living a history. History is that string of yesterdays. But does it matter? To some, there are treasures around us. If we want to see them, if you and I want to see them, we need to open our eyes wide and look for them. Don't be troubled by the sense of contempt you have in your mind. It is a quality that must be controlled, like too much salt or too much water. Just apply enough to enable your critical reasoning to occur, but then slip it back into the drawer and replace it with curiosity and a desire to answer the question. Not necessarily to look at the things that we want to see, but to open our minds. I found a scrap of paper the other day that I had written this on. I'm going to share it with you and see what you think. I was in sort of a reflective mood. I hope you're sitting back with your favorite glass of Kool-Aid in a big comfortable chair. Maybe you'll listen to this program in an evening, when you're thinking you'd just like to have this conversation with someone. I thought, destiny is not determined by men fearful of change, but by those for whom the uncertainty of the future is a beacon of opportunity. I was having a radical moment that day, that night. I said, Freemasonry achieved is like meeting yourself in a quiet cafe. And as the conversation unfolds, discovering a dark side, a thoughtful nature, and a struggle with shortcomings. A little too much honesty? Maybe it's better that all of you, 1,200 or 1,400 of you and me are in the same room at the same time. I hate that kind of intensity, don't you? Some of you have been asking about books and readings. And I'm a little bit hesitant, but I'm going to dig into my big sack of books here in a second and come up with a list. Just a second. There we are. I think if you're considering a library of Masonic material, you need to know I do have some prejudices, I guess, and prejudices, attitudes about it. You need to know I don't think the ideas that we deal with in Freemasonry are branded Masonic. Ideas are what they are. The brilliant and endurable ideas prevail, make a difference in our lives. If you are a man of faith or a person of faith, you will understand this. And if not, let's be patient and have a talk and see if you can at least put your doubts into a broader context. That's really what I'm talking about here. The context of ideas isn't contained by one order or another, one group or not. This is some of the battles that that great people seem to have to go through. My people came from Scotland and presumably a Celtic root at some point. And we were, of course, in much of Europe and even today, but back in those days, there were many, many battles that had to do with religion. And it was the battle of within the same religion, Christian fighting Christian, Catholic against Protestant. And those battles went on with a great deal of blood built for hundreds of years, until the madness drained out of us, until reason prevailed. So when we look at what's going on in the eastern part of the world, it can be confusing, Shiite and Sunni brethren. I don't necessarily understand it. It's complex, I'm sure. But if it relates to the history that had to do with my family, Protestant against Catholic, I get it. I hope that your resolution of these battles and wars are hastened so that you'd never have to cause the kind of loss that occurred in my own history, in the history of a lot of listeners. No one should have to endure that. No families, no mothers, no brothers, no fathers, no sisters, no great nation, but it seems that we have to repeat history. I think that's the price of the ignorance that occurs when we're just not able to be as well informed as we need. Made me think that the roots of Freemasonry perhaps were affected by things like the the Renaissance and the Reformation. And these are things that certainly had wide-reaching effects. Where I think that it was interesting was that what I think was interesting about the period was that it had to do with this term that I came across a while back called truth claimers. It was a battle about who could claim to be speaking the truth. And for various reasons, you know, it had to be fought, couldn't be reasoned, it had to be handled at the end of a sword. And then we began to realize that evidence seemed to give us a leg up. That claiming a truth based on evidence resonated with wise people. And those same wise people seemed to also realize, on the other hand, the need for moral balance, the metaphysics, the intangibles, the rules of life, if you will, the principles that guide. And in a way, we could say the science alone wasn't enough. But in fact, if you take that Hegelian kind of notion, in other words, step back, step up, take a look from a broader view, it seems to all fit together. And there are scholars that have been and continue to offer those links and bridges for us, for the likes of you and me, the students, with the questions, how does it fit together? Well, the first part of that is us wondering if it fits together and perhaps answering that it must, and then being curious enough and open-minded enough to answer that question for ourselves. It was that, I think, open-minded question and curiosity that drew many of us to this order, knowingly or indirectly. So I think the Renaissance probably had, that was, you know, the European Renaissance at least was between 14th and 17th centuries. And we know that it had a great deal of traction in Italy in the late Middle Ages, and later spread to the rest of Europe. And then you know, these are the influences that were occurring, the readings, the social evolution that was influencing the people that pulled together our order in early 18th century in London. They weren't foolish people. So we can have the structure of our order famously linked to guilds and stonemasons, and whether factually or in myth, linked to the fabulous architecture of the cathedrals. Buildings, the period. But then the Renaissance generated so much of a change, and to answer that question about truth claimers, from Da Vinci to Michelangelo. You know, remember the picture of the Renaissance man? This is a transformation between sort of an intellectual transformation, or the word that I like is bridging, between the Middle Ages and the modern era. So we can say generally and agree with the consensus that it began in Florence, Italy in the 14th century. These lessons weren't taught to me, because I wasn't asking the question. Now, I think it's kind of interesting. Where did the ideas that came? It's not just the politics or the structure of Freemasonry, but where did the ideas come from that were the foundation that I think are unassailable and should be challenged quite openly by anybody, because they have great depth? And if they cannot meet a challenge, we need to know that. We need to know. I tend to think that I can't say that, you know, in the world of probability that anything is infallible, but this is really comprehensive. And it's a thinking man's organization. And I think it reduces that notion of pessimism. You know, we have periods where we feel quite nostalgic and we appreciate things that were. And while, you know, socially and economically, those are new sciences that developed that weren't there before. Anybody that would claim that you know, science came to an end with mathematics, okay, not really buying it, but if you can convince yourself of the fact, go right ahead. These were influences. But I also like to play with the idea that it was because of sort of what I call the zaniness of Britain and Europe, particularly I think Britain, where there were, you know, this was a time where a civil war was behind them, where battle for supremacy of the ocean was prevalent. That there was sort of a wackiness or an oddity. And I think that was sort of an unexpected benefit of the period of Renaissance and Renaissance thinking, the change in thinking. Or change became not something to fear, but something to examine. We could find answers by looking in places we hadn't looked before, just like you do when you walk through the doors of a lodge. But it was that zaniness that I think allowed us to be more broadly accepted, not considered a huge threat. Yeah, there were people in pockets of concern, as there is today. But we had an ability to be accepted for what we were, a group of men, perhaps having esoteric quirky little thoughts, but generally the culture, whether it was because it was cosmopolitan, sophisticated, or just so old, that tolerated Freemasonry. The notion of men getting together was not exclusive to Freemasonry at all. Remember, we talked earlier about the advance of social organizations, social clubs in London, particularly at the time. There's a proliferation. So many that little historic notes mention some families noticing that father was away most nights of the week at the clubs. And some of them are more notorious and quite interesting than others. But we grew nevertheless. We began to, I think, have an opportunity to ask some deeper questions, to reflect, to be able to ponder the illusions, to look at the way things are, and begin to wonder whether they could be better, to begin to wonder our place in all of the things going on around us. To begin to address and deal with social injustice, the inequity of wealth. Remember the world of Ezra Pound, the world of Dickens, the descriptions of utter abject poverty, starvation, deprivation. While another smaller group of the society lived in affluence. Now, we seem to, if the pendulum swings too far away from this notion of common good, it seems always to come back. Who do we include in that sense of common good seems to fluctuate as the years go by. That, I think, is reasonable, don't you? It's an ever-changing environment that we live in. I want to talk with you a little bit about some of the books, though. You got me off topic here. I think if you're curious about Canada and what's going on, there's a couple of interesting books. One is The History of the Grand Lodge of Canada, Ancient Free and Accepted Masons. Fascinating book. There's two editions of it. Get the first one and read through. It's I don't know if it's necessarily definitive, but it contains a tremendous amount of useful information. And the other, in the same vein, you might want to get a copy of The History of Freemasonry in Canada by J. Ross Robertson. And that comes in two volumes. And that's more like copies of actual documents compiled. And I found that fascinating because it opened up a real understanding of what was going on with the development of Freemasonry in our part of the world. Now, if you want to know a little bit more about background information, like why are things the way they are today, you might like a copy of The Builders. It's a simple name, and it's written by a fellow named Joseph Fort Newton. And it gives an idea of the thinking between men. And that's something, if you're inclined and that's the kind of question that you're looking for, a little more background material, that might really give you a moment to pause. And of course, as you know, the fellow I would love to meet one day in the hereafter to continue the arguments, The Meaning of Freemasonry by W.L. Wilmshurst. That's his last name is Wilmshurst, W-I-L-M-S-H-U-R-S-T, William Leslie Wilmshurst. And he has essays that are in this book, and they seem to be lamentations. He's distressed that we don't seem to be getting it. You know, we're not doing enough. I'd like to be able to talk with William Leslie and perhaps see what he thinks about some of my reflections on that same topic. That, in fact, having people around not pulling their oar is absolutely necessary for us to attain a deeper sense of understanding of mankind and of ourselves. Tolerance. Our principles are not worth a fig unless they come into play when we're under stress, when we're pressured to do something impulsively, when we're pressured and we have in our own minds justification for walking away, for being insulting, for devaluing the work or effort. If our Masonic principles are not deep enough to change our behavior during those moments of trial, then what good are they? Lip service. Dress up. Pretend. I would surely challenge anybody that would say that's all we are. Some, yeah. Some probably. Some see things differently. All of us see things in our own way. And remember, we truly believe what we want to believe. So how do we persuade? I don't know if persuasion is exactly the right word. I think it's about influence, hegemony. How do we influence somebody lost in ignorance to know that they too can achieve insight? Yelling at them, laughing, mocking, we get that enough. Isolating, we get that enough. Making the person feel like a fool, like they've done something wrong, we get that enough too. presuming that the only genius in the room is the person behind our own eyes? How shallow, hmm? The truth of it is we're all in this together. We're trying some things, some brighter, some duller. But we've agreed to be part of a brotherhood, a fraternal order. And then nobody comes along with a manual and says, here, this is how you... Oh my goodness, there is a manual on it, isn't there? There is. That tells us how to treat one another, how to act, how to treat a stranger. The ancient charges teach us. So let me go back to the books I think would be, I would recommend. Now, very gently ease you into this. And next book is The Freemason's Guide and Compendium by Bernard E. Jones. I found it interesting. Now, these books are written at different times. And just like the King James Bible has been eclipsed by research, you know, some of the books in the Bible were written like 1,500 years after the events. And now with research, the change, things, my goodness, moved ahead. We now have reference material that's getting closer in some instances to between 300 and 500 years from the event. Let's presume a greater degree of accuracy. I think we can all agree on that. But it means that even the scripture is being rewritten, just as it was before it was handed to us. It was rewritten. So remember, when you're reading through Masonic material, you'll see what appears to be contradiction, but far from it. Look at the period when it's written, and you may find that the later period seems to be more accurate or has a different perspective because of new findings that were incorporated. Today, if we found an answer for a major scientific dilemma, the things that we write today would sound altogether different. It would be contradicting things that were written yesterday. So on that turning point, a reader in the future who can see contrast, and he could be well confused unless you keep this sense of ongoing perspective in mind. And you will, if you read through some of this material, some of these books, I think you'll find some of those differences. I certainly did. I'd like you to try and look for a copy of The Rise and Development of Organized Freemasonry. And this is by Roy A. Wells. I think you find that very interesting. Now, the more esoteric, you want to know ideas, you want to know a bit about history, just something on history of ideas, I would recommend the writings of a fellow named Daniel J. Borstein, Borstein. Daniel J. Borstein. And he was the Librarian of Congress for many, many years. I think he might even still be alive today. He is, I think, one of the most profound historians, natural historians that I had the good luck to discover many years ago. And he wrote, three pivotal books. The Discoverers, and this is one of the greatest books on history. And he wrote The Creators. And the third book that I would recommend is his book called The Seekers. Now, I won't get into all of it. The Discoverers was published in 1983, and it's sort of an overview by a historian and librarian, and the work is divided into four books inside of it. First is time, the second is earth and seas, the next is nature, and then the last is society, and concludes with suggestions for other readings and an index. And he presents an entertaining account of explorers, from Christopher Columbus and Captain Cook to scientists like Galileo and William Harvey and Charles Darwin. And then he goes on to with other investigators, including a very bright Jewish fellow, Karl Marx, Sigmund Freud, and the anthropologist Lewis Henry Morgan. And just to give you a sense of the man, he says that my hero is man the discoverer, and he depicts these numerous individuals as if in a heroic and triumphant struggle of intelligence over ignorance and illusion. So not quick reads, but compelling, just fascinating material. Now, if you're a little more reflective and you want, I would never want to discourage somebody reading Masonic material from embracing the myths and legends. They are really important to our process of understanding. They contain very valuable messages and information. But I think I always tended to think that my belief on Freemasonry, I hope, would be based in reality. And so I discovered a book, and I think it was my friend, I'll remember his name in a second. The book that I'm talking about here is Freemasonry, The Reality. And this is by Tobias Churton, Churton. Tobias Churton, Freemasonry, The Reality. And he sort of strips away, and it's like, you know, if a historian sat down with Dan Brown, and then you and I got to listen to their conversation. You know, it's like history is what it is. And Brown was an enormous storyteller. So the story helps, just like the stories always have, the oral history. And Freemasons should, I think, have a fondness for oral history. The stories, the oral history, contain deep lessons, important lessons. So that book, I think, helps us to understand. It strips away some of gives us some information to challenge some, you know, wrong-minded kinds of ideas, but replaces it with a very stimulating kind of platform for us to move forward. Now, of course, all of that said, if you are becoming a more serious student, plunge into all the used bookstores that you can find and look for copies of the Quatoral Coronati Lodge Minutes. And they're usually bound copies out there. And they're a bit esoteric for the general public, so they seem to be just sitting on shelves waiting for you and me. And there's one published every year. And you can join the correspondence circle, where you don't have a vote in Lodge, but you can gain, for a certain fee, you can get a copy of the papers that have been delivered in that year. And it is some of the finest, I would say arguably, some of the finest Masonic writings and research available to us. You access that through the United Grand Lodge of England. There's Quattro Coronati Lodge 2076. You can Google all of that information. There's district representatives here in Ontario, and they'll be very happy to help you, as they did with me, to make my application as a member of the correspondence circle. Our friend, and we have connections with that organization through a membership of Masons in the Grand Lodge of Canada and the province of Ontario. And I think you'll like it. So now, and of course, the book that we just finished reviewing here at some length, How to Live, A Life of Montaigne. And I would recommend the version, the compilation by Sarah Bakewell, B-A-K-E-W-E-L-L. That is, I think, the listeners who followed the review of that book is a compelling piece of information of a man who was teaching us and addressed the questions about how to live a better life. So some of the listeners may out there may be the Epicurean or the skeptic or the Stoic, but he will understand more about the advantages of a particular philosophical view on life. What Montaigne was doing was trying to avoid adding fuel to conflict, to be able to be optimistic and see the results, see the connections and the futility of war, to be able to rise above it all. And I think, at least for some of us, he was successful. He was able to teach, and we can be quite grateful for that, if nothing else. Now, I'm going to dig out a copy of The Short History of the Craft. This is a paper delivered at the 8th Biennial Conference of Canadian Grand and District Grand Lodges in Winnipeg in on February 16th, 1963. So, let me dig that little puppy out, and I'll be right back. Now, blame me. It's just something about Baroque music. I like Baroque. It sort of takes me immediately into a different kind of headspace. I'm listening in the background to Antonio Caldari. He wrote a trio of sonatas and cello sonatas. That was cello sonata number 5 in F major. Interesting little bit of work. So this is a little short history, and it is little, short history of the craft. So it tells us the origins of Freemasonry. And just to give you some context, dig out your copy of a book from Louis Masonic called Masonic Wisdom. And this is a collection of lectures given by prominent Masons active in the Philatelies chapters and Allied Masonic Degree Councils. So, and this copy I'm reading from is 2002. And from London, Ontario. The question, and under Appendix A, what is Freemasonry? It's one of the oldest secular fraternal societies. This leaflet is intended to explain Freemasonry as it practiced under the United Grand Lodge of England, which administers lodges of Freemasons in England and Wales and many places overseas. Freemasonry is a society of men concerned with moral and spiritual values. Its members are taught its precepts by a series of ritual dramas, which follow ancient forms and use stonemason customs and tools as allegorical guides. The key here being allegorical guides. The essential qualification of membership for admission into and continuing membership is a belief in a supreme being. Membership is open to men of any race or religion who can fulfill this essential qualification and are of good repute. It's not just enough to have the belief. And are of good repute. So in other words, fools need not apply. Freemasonry is not a religion, nor is it a substitute for religion. Its essential qualifications opens it to men of many religions, and it expects them to continue to follow their own faith. It does not allow religion to be discussed at its meetings. It's no excuse for not having a connection. It's not like a free get-out-of-church card saying that you agree to be a man of faith and to practice your faith. You figure it out. You do the math. But that's your obligation. It's based on three great principles. Brotherly love, which means every true Freemason will show tolerance and respect for the opinions of others and behave with kindness and understanding to his fellow creatures. Again, only when it matters. And it only matters when it's hard. And it only matters when you don't want to do it. The second principle is relief. Freemasons are taught to practice charity and to care not only for their own, but also for the community as a whole, both by charitable giving and by voluntary efforts and works as individuals. Charitable giving, voluntary efforts, and works as individuals. And finally, truth. Freemasons strive for truth, requiring high moral standards and aiming to achieve them in their own lives. Freemasons believe that these three principles, brotherly love, relief, and truth, represent a way of achieving higher standards in life. No possible way in this lifetime do we achieve higher standards by paying lip service to them. Yeah, brotherly love, relief, truth, got it. Your feet are in clay. You're going nowhere. Charity. From its earliest days, Freemasonry has been concerned with the care of orphans, the sick, and the aged. This work continues today. In addition, large sums are given to national and local charities. So I wonder if we're going to see a development of homes for older Freemasons as they age and whether their spouse is with them or not. I think there are some districts working on these projects. And I would wonder, I guess maybe I'm naive, why not every district? Because there's a lot of us, 43,000 of us aging right now. But what happens when we, why should we be isolated? Especially in old age. Freemasonry demands from its members a respect for the law of the country in which a man works and lives. Sort of bursts the bubble of me thinking that everything that I do is the only way it should be done. The only way I handle a fork is the proper way. The beverage that I choose is the only real beverage. It means that I'm a citizen of the world, a creature influenced by the culture, and it's up to me to open my eyes, pay careful attention, and accommodate, fit in. Its principles do not in any way conflict with its members' duties as citizens, but should strengthen them in fulfilling their public and private responsibilities. The use by a Freemason of his membership to promote his own or anyone else's business, professional, or personal interest is condemned and is contrary to the conditions on which he sought admission to Freemasonry. I had the fortune to meet a fellow who had joined clearly just to promote himself, trying to improve his career, leverage opportunities. It was really sad, and I thought, I came to terms with it because I remembered the lesson an ancient native elder in Yellowknife had taught me, that brother is living that tragedy placed there by the great creator to teach us. Everybody has purpose. His duty as a citizen must always prevail over any obligation to other Freemasons. And any attempt to shield a Freemason who has acted dishonorably or unlawfully is contrary to this prime duty. I guess it would be me, to me, it would behoove each one of us never to put another brother in that situation where he would even consider acting dishonorably. It's not he who has failed to protect me, but me who has put him in that untenable situation. The shame. The secrets of Freemasonry are concerned with its traditional modes of recognition. It is not a secret society, since all members are free to acknowledge their membership and will do so in response to inquiries for respectable reasons. You act a fool, you make us all appear the fool. You trivialize, flip a sign out in public because you can. You embarrass us all. You minimize and detract from the sincerity, the gravity of our order. You decide. We all have to tolerate each other. Hmm? Remember, we respond not to a glib challenge, but a serious-minded or respectable inquiry. We're not going to trivialize this by throwing mud. Its constitutions and rules are available to the public. There is no secret about any of its aims and principles. Like many other societies, it regards some of its internal affairs as private matters for its members. Hear, hear. Hear, hear. If I can't talk to anybody outside of a Masonic lodge about the principles of charity or the principles of common good or truth, the principles of tolerance, then there's a failing, isn't there? Isn't there? And for me to pretend that because I haven't done my homework, that it's I can make an excuse. It's just a secret. I'd love to be able to talk to you, but if that's code for I haven't got a clue, it might be more fitting to say there's so much about this order that I still have to know. That's honest. Any man can say that. I don't know the answer to your question, but I can find somebody that does. Freemasonry is non-political, and the discussion of politics at Masonic meetings is forbidden. Truly, seeing two people butt heads over politics is a sure way to make us all look like fools. And boys, we don't need more ways to do that. We've got enough of them. Thank goodness we're just told to be polite and not do it in a closed lodge. Freemasonry is practiced under many independent Grand Lodges with standards similar to those set in the United Grand Lodge of England. There are some Grand Lodges and other apparent Masonic bodies that do not meet these standards. They do not believe in a supreme being or which allow or encourage their members as such to participate in political matters. These Grand Lodges and bodies are not recognized by the United Grand Lodge of England as being Masonically regular, and Masonic contact with them is forbidden. A Freemason is encouraged to do his duty first to his God through his faith and religious practice, and then, without detriment to his family and those dependent on him, to his neighbor through charity and service. None of these ideas is exclusively Masonic, but all should be universally acceptable. Freemasons are expected to follow them. So we can talk. That gives you just an intro. Here's that little pamphlet now, printed in 1963. John F. Kennedy was in the White House. Who was in Diefenbaker in the Prime Minister of Canada? What then are the origins of Freemasonry? Many theories have been advanced and argued with commendable enthusiasm, but have had to be abandoned in the face of cold logic and historical facts. None of us will accept the belief that our history can be traced through devious ways to the building of King Solomon's temple at Jerusalem. Yet many of our new members, denied proper instruction, are left with the impression that this is actually true. Ah, dear. A theory that began to take form late in the 18th century ascribed our remote origin to the ancient mysteries. I even love the term. You got to admit, it has appeal. It was held that from them, Freemasonry has inherited some secret doctrine. This came to be widely accepted in the 19th century, but by the beginning of the 20th century, it became obsolete. There is absolutely no historical evidence to show that the supposed secrets of the ancient mysteries, and we have no actual knowledge of what they were, are in any way connected with our craft. The mysteries only persisted in a corrupt form until the 5th century and then perished. The old charges are entirely ignorant of classical Rome or Greece. We may admit the possibility of our craft degrees having been influenced by individual mysteries, mystics or Rosicrucians, and at the same time dismiss utterly and completely any suggestion that speculative masonry is in the slightest degree a survival of the Rosicrucian cult, or that it is the 17th century invention of its adherents, organized or otherwise. But, sir, I have an imagination. Let me run amok with it and come up with some fantastical story. Anyway, the belief that the so-called Comanche masters had some connection with Freemasonry was rather widely accepted some 40 or 50 years ago. So that would have been in the 1920s. And it still turns up occasionally in modern writings. It was stated that through these Comanche masters of the craft can be traced back to the Roman Collegia. They were said to be builders of a superior class from Como in Lombardy, northern Italy, who were formed into an association or fraternity. It was claimed that they traveled widely by permission of the Pope, building churches, and according to some, reached even to England and Scotland. It has no more basis of proof than many other theories of our origin. Mainly its foundation is that a play on words. Mainly its foundation is just a play on words. Wherever Comanche masters are mentioned, it was assumed that reference was to Lake Como in Italy. The word Comanche had been in use long before that time and had a wide application. The late Douglas Knopp, one of the most eminent of our modern Masonic historians, states, "Not a scrap of record evidence has been found to establish the existence of this migrant fraternity." And the basis seems to be mainly a mistaken etymology. For Comanchinus probably meant fellow Mason, without reference to Como or any other place. An attempt has been made to connect Freemasonry with the Compagnonage of France. This organization has many similarities to early operative Masonry with an initiation ceremony, secrets, and legends. It was essentially a journeyman's organization, its primary concern being with the traveling companions. It remained throughout the 19th century a form of labor organization, and as such could show no relationship with the Freemasonry that had been introduced in France from England in the 1720s and 1730s, and which was not concerned with the journeyman's interests. Another organization which some claim to have influenced the growth of Freemasonry is the German Steinmetzen, a craft guild having many similarities with our institution. It had, however, an absolutely independent origin, and its legends were distinct from ours, just as with the Compagnonage of France when Freemasonry was introduced into Germany in the 18th century. There was no recognition of any connection between the two societies. We come then to this conclusion that our Freemasonry is purely Anglo-Saxon in its origin, and it is to England and Scotland that we must look exclusively for the story of its development. One of the most significant influences in the development of our craft is that of the old charges or manuscript constitutions. We cannot here enter into a detailed discussion of these documents, but their importance in the growth of Freemasonry has long been established. There are about 100 of these manuscripts now in existence. I think they're closer today to about 132. And they are entirely the product of English operative masonry. They date from the end of the 14th century to sometime about 1725. Masonic historians agree that even the earliest of these, the Regius manuscript, to which has been assigned the date 1390, and the Cook manuscript, thought to be around the period of 1400 to 1410, were copies of still earlier originals unknown to us. All the versions now known have thus been copied and recopied and even edited or changed. It is not possible to trace their sources. Each version of the manuscript constitutions usually consists of two distinct parts beside the invocation. These are the legendary history, a highly imaginative account of the origin and the progress of the craft, and the regulations or charges. These regulations were rules to govern the workman's conduct in his relations with his work, his master or employer, and his fellow worker. We cannot, of course, know who were the authors of the original versions of these manuscripts, but for the close relationship between the building fraternity and the church, and the fact that the ordinary workman of the time was completely illiterate, it can be accepted that they were written by some monk or clerk connected with the church. They were meant to be read to the masons working on some building project. It has been said that they were read to the lodge, but there is no evidence of a general organization of masons in the early days of the operative craft. The lodge came into existence automatically. The master collected his workmen, and their workroom was their lodge. When the building was completed, the workmen dispersed, and that lodge ceased to exist. The value of the manuscript constitutions lies in this, that they preserved the traditions of the mason's craft over the centuries. As they were read to the lodge of masons engaged on some building project, so evidently they continued to be read in the early lodges of accepted masons. Later, these charges were replaced by the newer version compiled by Dr. Anderson in 1723. Before the days of Grand Lodge, the test of the regularity of any gathering of masons was, it appears, the position of a copy of the old charges. Warrants or charters did not come into use until later in the 18th century. The first warrants were issued by the Grand Lodge of Ireland in 1731. That's a very long time ago. These manuscript constitutions give us little information about the organization of the craft in the Middle Ages. They speak of assemblies of masons to discuss the affairs of the craft as far back as the 10th century. But from the conditions prevailing at those times, there could have been no national assembly for the regulation of trade matters. There may have been regional or local assemblies, but that is a mere possibility, for we do not know with any certainty that such gatherings were ever held. Much has been written of the English craft guilds and their influence on Freemasonry. The history of the trade and craft guilds is complicated, and there is much disagreement among historians as to the course of their development. The earliest guilds were religious organizations, both on the continent and in England. And over several centuries, they kept their close connection with the church. The guild was designed to watch over the interests of the skilled workmen, but maintained its religious aspect. By the time of the Reformation in the 16th century, they were already declining in influence and lost most of their power when Henry VIII had confiscated their money and possessions. Guilds were essentially city organizations. Each was limited to the craftsmen of one trade within the limits of a city. Thus, from the very nature of a guild, it is evident that Masonry could not have been controlled by such an organization. Practically all the work of Masons was carried on outside the city, and the workmen had to move from place to place. Indeed, might even be impressed to work on some important building. It is generally thought that it was because Masons were not covered by trade guilds that the manuscript charges came into use in the regulation of a very loosely knit fraternity. There is but one definitely known exception to this condition, just referred to, and that is the Masons Company of London. There may have been Masons guilds in a few other centers in England, but we do not know. And if there were, there is no positive evidence that they were concerned with the regulations of the trade. The first reference to the London Company is found in 1376, and it was one of the many craft guilds in that city. This organization governed the Mason trade in London, and no one could work at this trade without its authority. The influence of the company declined in the 17th century, and its monopoly was finally broken by the conditions following the Great Fire of London in 1666. It was not able to control the large number of foreign workmen, that is, from other parts of Great Britain, who flocked to the city, and the company could not cope with the tremendous amount of work required in rebuilding. Imagine rebuilding London. The main point of interest to our present fraternity and the London Company is that fact that there were formed a separate organization connected with the company, but which was not concerned with trade matters. This was the exception evidence, of which is found in an account book of the company dated 1620. This exception was in the nature of a fraternity or lodge separate from the parent body and with no interest in the Mason's trade, but having its finances controlled by the company. Why it was formed, we do not know. If it had anything more than a social purpose, we have no knowledge of it. It is, in effect, the earliest known lodge of accepted Masons. Though its members were not referred to as such until the early part of the 18th century, 1770s, huh? 1717, we have little or no knowledge of its organization or procedure, but it was generally believed to be the lodge held at Masons Hall, which Elias Ashmole states he attended in 1682. Nothing is known of the lodge after that date. There is positive evidence then that accepted Masonry existed in London and was active before the end of the 17th century, or the 1600s, of course. There is also evidence of other lodges of accepted Masons in England at that time. We have the entry of the diary of Elias Ashmole that he was made a Mason at Warrington in 1646. And the statement of Randall Holme that he was made a Mason at Chester, probably in the 1670s. From these records, it would be correct to say that these two men, and doubtless many others, were made Masons, not in an operative lodge, but in a group of accepted Masons. Huh. Fancy that. Among them may have been some operatives. But such lodges were merely occasional or of a semi-permanent nature, had no connection with the operative craft. The only known operative lodges in England outside of London were at Elmwick, whose minutes show that it was in existence in 1701, and at Swalwell, an unattached lodge of which the first authentic records date from 1725, though it was evidently in existence before that date. Huh. Imagine that. As these lodges were not far from the Scottish border, we are led to conclude that there was a Scottish influence in their practices. No non-operatives or gentlemen Masons were associated with these lodges before 1730. So let me finish today with just a little bit about information about Scottish Masonry, and we'll come back to this. It's an interesting little pamphlet, I think you'll agree. The development of Masonry in Scotland followed an entirely different pattern than that in England. Comes as no surprise, I guess. There, the trade was much more closely knit, and we have clear evidence of an organized craft, with a great deal of cooperation and collaboration in different parts of Scotland. This collaboration centers mostly in the King's Master of the Works, who, along with the masters of the head lodges, constituted the central authority controlling the various local lodges. The statutes drawn up in 1598 and 1599 by William Scaw, then King's Master of the Works, set out the duties and responsibilities of the workmen. They use the word lodge, referring to a body of Masons controlling the building activity in a particular town. These will be distinguished from a group of operatives meeting in a lodge or workshop attached to a building site. The lodges controlling the trade in a town were under the supervision of head lodges, such as those in Kilwinning, Edinburgh, and Glasgow. Such Mason trade bodies authorized the admission of apprentices. First, these apprentices were booked by the municipal authorities. Later, they were entered in the lodge and thus became part of the local lodge organization. At the end of their term of training, these entered apprentices, if found worthy, were made fellows of craft. There is, of course, much uncertainty about the details of these customs and how these lodges operated in different countries. The one fact that which emerges is the close organization of the Mason's craft in Scotland, working through recognized operative lodges, a condition which is not definitely known in England except in London. Records dating from the year 1634 and throughout the century that followed showed that in Scotland many non-operatives, men who were not actual Masons, were admitted members of operative lodges. Mostly these were of the nobility or gentry. Huh, imagine that. And they were referred to as gentlemen Masons. They were, in effect, honorary members, though they had paid a fee for admission, and this fee would be higher than that paid by an operative member admitted to the lodge. Huh. How much the increasing number of non-operatives or gentlemen Masons contributed to the changing character of the lodges for purely operative to accepted masonry is not known. It is generally thought that the change came about through changing social conditions rather than by the influence of the non-operatives. In England, the existence of organized operative lodges outside the London Masons Company is purely problematical. Operative lodges in Alnwick and Swalwell and the beginning of the 18th century were, as has been pointed out, undoubtedly influenced by Scottish practice. Consequently, we have no evidence in England of non-operatives joining operative lodges as in Scotland. Men were made Masons in the purely occasional or semi-permanent groups having no connection with the Masons' trade. Because of this, it was in England that accepted masonry, as distinguished from non-operative masonry, developed much earlier than in Scotland, and so finally became the speculative craft known to us today. Let me go over that again. Men were made Masons in the purely occasional or semi-permanent groups having no connection with the Masons' trade. Because of this, it was in England that the accepted masonry was distinguished from non-operative masonry, developed much earlier than in Scotland, and so finally became the speculative craft known to us today. The speculative craft was a development of the 18th century. Now we have upon us, when I come back next week, we'll talk about Masonic ceremonies. Interesting little pamphlet. You would think that if it was offered to a conference of Canadian Grand and District Grand Lodges, that it would have some accuracy behind it, and I think we can all agree that it does. We're talking about 15th, 16th, 17th, 18th century social development or history, and talking about influences on us, on our fraternal order in the early days, things that formed the rules, if you want to put it that way, the guidelines. 16th century was an interesting time. It's an age of discovery. It's known even as the Age of Exploration. It started in the early 15th century and continued to the 17th century. The Europeans explored Africa and the Americas, Asia and Oceania. It was the fall of Constantinople in 1453 that severed European trade links by land with Asia, leading many to seek trade routes by sea, and spurred the Age of Exploration. So we saw the Portuguese and Spanish went long distance to travel along shores to find alternate routes so that they could move, they could trade gold and silver and spices. But the Age of Discovery can also be seen as a bridge between the Middle Ages again and the modern era, with its contemporary Renaissance movement triggering the early modern period and the rise of European nation-states. Accounts from some distant lands and maps spread with the help of new printing press fed the rise of humanism and worldly curiosity, ushering in a new age of scientific and intellectual inquiry. European overseas expansion led to the rise of colonial empires, and with the contact between the old and new worlds, producing the Columbian Exchange, a wide transfer of plants, animals, food, human populations, sadly even slaves, and communicable diseases and cultures between the East and West is one of the most significant global events concerning ecology and agriculture and culture in history. European exploration allowed the global mapping of the world, resulting in a new worldview and distant civilizations acknowledging each other, reaching the most remote boundaries much later. It wasn't all that long ago. So give us a bit of time to catch up and start the dialogue. The more we communicate, the more the exchange of ideas happens, the more we find balance points and compromise that will work. Remember, it is our job to find that one religion on which all people agree. I think Freemasonry is a symbol of that progress. And we are unlike other groups. Similar, but always unlike. Do we carry forward that message? Well, if we don't, who does? History, natural laws barometer, will not be kind. It will not even mention the pettiness that we exhibit. It will not ever mention the quarrel or the unfairness or the oily politics that happens inevitably. It will only remember the fact that we are able to work together, were able to work together in 2012 and achieve something of merit, or even better, that we were sufficiently curious to try innovation. Well, that means we're going to have to be a bit unpopular, wouldn't you say? Innovators are never welcome. Oh, 100 years later, we're all jumping on the bandwagon. You're our man. But in the day, we'll do everything to despise and discredit. How in the world do we ever accomplish those types of things? Accomplish anything when we're so harsh on genius? We keep plugging away. It seems, in spite of the naysayers and the growly malcontents among us, progress is absolutely inevitable. I hope I get a chance to talk with you again. We get a chance to talk again real soon. If you're around Cambridge on Wednesday, you might come out to Heritage Lodge. There's a talk going on in living history. I think it'd be interesting. The next show is coming up on Sunday, the 30th of September. If you want it, tune in live at 10:30 in the morning. It's called Familiarity Breeding Contempt. Imagine that. We only have a few hundred years of history that we have to account for. You think anybody can start up organizations. Anyone can progress, but we have to answer to our own history. It's right there around us. No sugarcoat. History is that unvarnished biography. The only way we generate education from our past is by looking at our own history objectively. Not what we want to see, but what's there. See you soon. In the meantime, I hope the great architect watches over each and every one of you, and that you can continue to commit random acts of Masonic kindness. Bye.
Thank you.